You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The rise of the bin Laden family from desert poverty in Yemen to Saudi Arabian millions is a near epic tale that spans the course of the last century with ramifications that resonate well into this one. In a new book that Michiko Kakutani calls riveting in today's New York Times, Steve Call relates the story of the family that produced the world's most wanted terrorist. It's called The Bin Ladens, an Arabian Family in the American Century, and it's published by Penguin. I'm very pleased that it brings Steve Call back to the show today. Hello.
Hey, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
What was your goal in this examination of Osama bin Laden that's different? How is he usually characterized?
Well, in my own work on him in the past and in most other work on him, he's been understandably located in the stream of international Islamist radicalism that grew up in the Middle East and Central Asia after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 79 and the Iranian Revolution. And so he's mostly resided in our understanding as a creature of those campaigns and particularly the war in Afghanistan. And those are valid ways to understand him, but having worked on that aspect of his identity, I always felt that I was bouncing off of another important context in which he resided, and that was the Saudi and sort of family context that also belonged to him.
Your Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Ghost Wars, explores the history of the CIA in Afghanistan from the 1980s through the September 11th attacks. And you were here to talk about that, but the last time you were here, we discussed a New Yorker piece that was largely focused on Osama's high school experiences. And that is the period of real transition.
He was recruited while attending an elite prep school in Jeddah, a school that was modeled on British culture and curricula. And it was a place where the boys, all boys, they wore gray slacks and blue blazers. And he was recruited by a Syrian gym teacher who was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood in a way that is actually quite typical, both of the way the Muslim Brotherhood develops adherents and also the way other proselytizing groups recruit adolescents in the Gulf. And
can't we say in other religious groups as well, after school activities?
Yes, absolutely. And here, one wants to be careful about what is distinctive about such after school confirmation age study. On the face of it, very little, except with the Brotherhood, there are a couple of sort of extensions of the ordinary religious practice for young adolescents. One is there's a strong political agenda, a revolutionary agenda rooted in the Brotherhood's anti-colonial sort of origins. And also there is a clandestine membership aspect of the Brotherhood that is deepened, as one progresses toward membership, one moves into a secret realm. And so those are, I think, distinctive aspects of his high school era recruitment.
Well, in a photograph in your book of the family in Sweden, it was also published in Today's Times, it's from 1971, and all but one of the family members look quite westernized. Only one girl is wearing a headscarf. Mm. Osama is not in that picture. Where was he at the time?
He was almost certainly in Saudi Arabia, although that also could have been the period when he briefly attended a Quaker boarding school in Lebanon. He belonged to a section of the family, the generation of Muhammad's children, 54 in number, who were more Arabian than international, although he did travel abroad, traveled to London, and by a couple of reliable accounts, perhaps once traveled to the United States. But he was in his schooling and in his orientation, and particularly after he became deeply religious at about age 13 or 14, a much more a creature of the Arabian Peninsula than many of his siblings and cousins.
And it's a huge family photo. So we're talking about a lot of people all emanating from one bricklayer in Yemen.
Mohammed bin Laden, an extraordinary man. His father and his grandfather all lived and farmed in an arid, impoverished section of Yemen called the Hadramaut, where they had tiny plots of land that they could only cultivate periodically when flood rains came in that could be captured and used to irrigate. And he was, Muhammad, that is Osama's father, was orphaned as a boy and migrated, as many Hadramis did, walked with his brother out from these canyons to the sea, made his way onto a boat, supported by networks of diaspora networks, kin networks, but still on his own, and makes his way all the way to Saudi Arabia, where he arrives as a teenager at the cusp of the Depression, and from there builds gradually the family fortune.
And you call that first chapter In Exile. You also call your last chapter In Exile.
Well, one of the themes that some of the scholars that I encountered when I was researching this out in the Gulf really impressed upon me was the character of this Hadrami diaspora, which is really unknown in the West. We understand diasporas. We understand the Jewish diaspora. We understand the Chinese and Indian diasporas, really robust transnational networks of people bound by identity, language, experience, who become accomplished in part because of their mobility and the circumstances of exile in which they find themselves. Well, in the Arab world, the Hadramis are well known as such a diaspora, even though not so well recognized in the West. They migrated out from the earliest periods of Islam as soldiers, as businessmen. They rose to prominence in many Islamic societies, into the highest ranks of government in Indonesia and India and so forth. So the point is that the bin Ladens did not invent themselves from scratch. Their ambition and Muhammad's ambition was rooted in his own culture, and he had many examples around him to inspire his ambition, men who had succeeded and built great fortunes and castles and that sort of thing.
But he was a bricklayer, but he arrives at the right moment to rise to something else?
Well, not initially exactly at the right moment. He arrives at the cusp of the Great Depression, and business is kind of collapsing in Saudi Arabia, as everywhere. He sort of hustles for a while, gets by, teaches himself to be a bricklayer, finds a position with Aramco, the American oil company that's beginning to pump oil in Saudi Arabia. But it's really not till the end of the Second World War, after the disruption in international shipping and so forth, when Saudi Arabia finally begins to enjoy the benefits of the oil that Americans had discovered in the early 30s. And it's then that Muhammad really starts to take off.
And he's obviously very ambitious. This is something that's passed on to all of the people in the family who follow him. What about his religious beliefs? How religious was he?
He was a very devout man, a very conservative man, I think characteristic of his time and place. He was not especially political about his religion, but he was. It was a very important part of his identity, the way he lived his life, the lessons he taught his children. And it became more so because of his extraordinary achievement as a businessman, which was to win the exclusive right to undertake construction and renovation work in Mecca and Medina. Two great holy cities of Islam. And then also eventually Jerusalem, with Saudi sponsorship. He won a contract let by the Hashemite kingdom, which controlled then East Jerusalem, and appointed bin Laden to renovate the Dome of the Rock and the surrounding sanctuary.
And was he given those assignments because he was perceived as a devout man?
I think that he advertised himself in the bid documents, which we were able to acquire in Jerusalem, the original letters and submissions that he submitted. He describes himself. He basically writes to the decision-making committee and says, look, I'm here as a Muslim. I'm going to undertake this not for business reasons, but for charitable reasons. And he kept lowering his bid and emphasizing in his letters, this is personal. It's not a business contract for me.
My guest is Steve Call, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Ghost Wars. His latest is The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century, published by the Penguin Press. He rose to great prominence in Saudi Arabia. What role did the family play within the running of the country?
Well, they were, in a sense, they became the sort of Halliburton of Saudi Arabia, in the sense that, particularly under King Faisal, they were granted no-bid, sole-source contracts to undertake really important defense and sensitive defense and intelligence-oriented projects For instance, during the 1960s, though we've long forgotten this, Saudi Arabia was threatened by a war with Yemen, with Egyptian troops occupying Yemen, and the Egyptians under Nasser were trying to overthrow the Saudi royal family. Well, the Saudi government had no defensive frontier across its vast southern border. It appointed the bin Ladens to go down there and build it in collaboration with the United States and Britain, all clandestine projects. So they had these exclusive spheres of business, both in the defense sector and then in the religious sector in Mecca and Medina. And through that, they acquired access to all kinds of quarters in the Saudi government. But I think it's important to emphasize that in social terms, they were always outsiders.
Because they were still always seen as Yemenites?
Because they were Yemenis. And in Saudi Arabia, there's an extraordinary focus on genealogy and social status and purity of genealogy. And the great status resides in the central tribes in the Nejd, who are not just the royal family, but also the associated families. And for a Yemeni on the coast, an immigrant, there was no way to penetrate those social circles. No matter how much money you had, you might be admired for your entrepreneurial skill and for your genius, but admired from a distance.
And your children born in Saudi Arabia, they'd still be the children of a Yemeni.
The path for those children, yes, very much so. They could never marry into a Saudi. It would be much easier for them to marry into an elite American family than into an elite Saudi family.
But they still became a prominent family, an important business fixture in the country. Has that changed at all since Osama bin Laden became an international figure? Because they seem to be maintaining a much lower profile.
Well, it certainly has affected them, but it hasn't undermined their position as a successful business family and a successful business organization, nor has it caused them to lose any of the access to lucrative contracts that they've enjoyed.
I've read a lot over the years about the competing pressures and temptations that affect the wealthier citizens of Saudi Arabia. How did the bin Laden family deal with that? The lure of the West at the same time, the very powerful religious aspect of the country.
Well, they were part of a generation of Arabians who came of age during the oil shock, and they were part of a subset of that generation that enjoyed extraordinary privileges, the wealth that their father created and which then they advanced through their work in the businesses, allowed this generation of bin Ladens to which Osama belonged to enjoy allowances, you know, in the hundreds of thousands of tax-free dollars a year in the early 1970s, early 1970s dollars. So they could purchase just about any identity they wanted. And some of them went west, literally and sort of spiritually. And they became very mobile. And as they traveled by private jet and on both recreation and business trips to Europe and the United States increasingly, they confronted this question of who are you and what do you believe and to what extent are you a Saudi and to what extent are you an international person and to what extent are you a Muslim and so forth. And each of the 54 seems to have fashioned their own answer. But I would just say that in comparison to perhaps some other privileged Saudis of their generation, they were rooted. They were rooted by their father's values, by their connections to Mecca and Medina, and by a sense of very strong family belonging.
He had 54 children. Was that unusual?
It was unusual, but hardly unheard of. There were many examples to inspire such conduct for a conservative, sort of old-fashioned sheikh such as Muhammad, and the most prominent examples were in the Saudi royal family. King Saud had more than 100 children. King Abdulaziz, the founding king, had an uncounted number above 100 and so forth.
Well, how did he react to the Western influence on his family, on his children?
Muhammad? Mm-hmm. Well, he died before he could really reckon with the fullness of the contradictions that it would create for his generation of children, because by the time he died in a plane accident in 1967, he was clearly a modernizer in the family. He was comfortable working with Americans. He had a New York agent as early as the 1950s. He had American executives and engineers in his company. Even in Jerusalem, he worked while working on these holy sites. there he had Italian Catholics in his work crews. And so he was a pluralistic, modernizing character who was at the same time illiterate and very much an Arabian. And so he wanted his sons to move into the modern world. He sent his eldest son to prep school in Britain. He sent others to Quaker schools in Lebanon. But his own identity was that of a patriarch rooted in an earlier tradition.
And his eldest son, Salem bin Laden, played a major role in America. We'll talk about that. They all were investing in American real estate, weren't they?
They were. They sort of preferred things on the ground or in the ground to financial stocks and bonds. But
Steve Call, his latest book, The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century, is published by the Penguin Press. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Steve Call, whose latest book is The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century, published by the Penguin Press. You spent 20 years at the Washington Post. Were people at the Post aware of the Bin Laden family?
Well, with a colleague of mine named Steve Levine, who ended up at the Wall Street Journal, we wrote a story about Osama in the summer of 1993.
On Osama.
How old was and also about the Bin Laden sort of context, the fortune that he seemed to be exploiting. He was then, this was right after the first World Trade Center bombing, and there was, I don't believe we thought that he was connected to that bombing, but we were trying to explore the context of transnational post-Cold War Islamic radicalism, and his name surfaced, so we wrote about him.
Which one of the children was his father?
Which one?
Was Osama's father? Of the 50, oh, was Osama the son
Osama was a son of Muhammad.
Muhammad. Yes. He's one of the 54.
He's one of the 25 sons and 29 daughters of Muhammad.
Was there a total gap between him and someone like Salem bin Laden?
Yeah, his father arrives in Saudi Arabia as a teenager in 1929 or 30. He doesn't have his first child until just about the end of the Second World War. And at that point, he's just started to make enough of a living to begin to marry and have children. So his first child is probably Salem. Actually, his first child was a daughter. He was probably born in 1943. His first son was born probably about in 1944. Nobody kept track of exact dates. And then he had children from 1944 right up until his death in 1967. The last name for him, Muhammad, was born after his death in memory of him. So Osama, born probably in January 1958, was one of a large cluster of children who were born right in that period of the 50s. That was the peak of Muhammad's marrying and fathering children. And in fact, I, looking at records I was able to obtain from court filings, concluded that I think there were 7 children born right in the same period when Osama was born.
And Osama was just a boy when he died. Had he had much contact with his father?
I think,
were there father figures out there?
Yes. He was 10 or 11, and his father treated all of his sons as Islamic law required. That is to say, they were fully legitimate, and they were treated equally as shareholders in his estate and as his heirs. And he was a man who gathered his sons together in a kind of Arabian style, in a formal setting where he would have them recite Quranic verses or teach them, try to transmit his values. He was a father of a sort you might expect from a self-made man, in the sense that he preached frugality and hard work and tried not to let his sons become too spoiled by his success.
Considering how key a role they were playing in Saudi Arabia and how much they depended on the royal family for their success, should we be surprised that Osama broke with the Saudi family?
Yes. But what's interesting is that he broke after a long period of being a rather orthodox figure as a young man. I think this really struck me, going back at his life this time in this context, that through the 1980s, when he was on the frontier in Afghanistan, and even into the early 1990s, though we might view his ideology as radical, in fact, he was operating as a very orthodox Saudi figure. He was a legitimate representative of his family business on the Afghan frontier. This was the extension of this sort of Halliburton role that they played. If you had in a sensitive, covert war that the Saudi government was involved in, well, of course you'd turn to the bin Ladens because they were discreet, they were reliable, they had a history of collaborating on such projects. And Osama, because of his piety and his religiosity and his enthusiasm, he was a natural sort of field representative, project manager for such work.
And Salim was selling arms.
Yeah, Salim, who was
his westernized brother, was selling him arms.
And that just emphasizes how sort of authorized this all was. Because for Salim, selling weapons and providing money to Osama was not an act of religious or political commitment. It was a business proposition, an adventure, and another way to serve the royal family. And so you had these odd bedfellows aligned, just as you had the United States and Saudi Arabia aligned at the government level.
Salim also died in a plane crash. He was piloting his own plane, and it crashed in 1988. How might events have been different if that hadn't happened?
Well, a lot of people who knew Salim, he died in a ultralight, a recreational aircraft accident. Really sad because he was a very talented pilot, and the accident was kind of a freak event. But he, a lot of people who knew him and loved him, and there were many that found him a sort of charming character, believe to this day that if he had lived, 9/11 wouldn't have happened. And their argument is that he was a very powerful leader of the bin Laden family. He had a very strong relationship with Osama. And he was just a force of nature. And if Osama had gone off the reservation while he was around, he would have done whatever was necessary to put that to a close. If he had involved, you know, wrapping Osama in a burlap bag and bringing him back to Saudi Arabia, Salim would have found a way to do it.
Steve Call is my guest. He's written The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century, published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you think that the creation of al-Qaeda was influenced by what Osama had learned from the family business?
I think his success as the leader of al-Qaeda from its founding to 9/11 is rooted to an extent in the inspiration that his father and his family provided in a couple of senses. One, his father was an extraordinary leader of diverse followers. He was a great leader of pluralism and diversity in his business and in Saudi society. Got along with everybody, made lots of different people work hard under his leadership, and he was very successful.
It was a construction company, and I would assume that he was relying on a lot of people who were not Saudis to work in that construction
exactly.
company.
Christians, Americans, Palestinians, Africans, Yemenis, Saudis alike, Pakistanis, Indians, Afghans, they were all in the business, and he made them all kind of come together. And they were very loyal to the bin Laden family. It was a place where people stayed and liked to work. And Osama obviously inculcated some, or was born with some of these skills, because what made him distinctive as a terrorist militia leader over 15 years was his ability to build a broad coalition of followers. And that very, very difficult to do in, a violent business like a terrorist militia formation. And he wasn't ever hindered by disputes over nationality, language, race, ethnicity. He gathered Africans and Asians and Pakistanis and Indians and Bangladeshis, as well as Saudis and so on. And so that's one strain that I see connecting him to his father and to his family. Another is his embrace of modernity and technology and the technologies of globalization. The bin Ladens in Saudi Arabia were pioneers of a transnational modern life. They were part of a diaspora, as we talked about earlier, but Osama was effective in the same way.
But it's interesting. Here is a man whose ideology sounds very anti-Western, and at the same time, he draws so much upon all Western technology, Western ideas.
He had a very kind of modern context in which he grew up as an Islamic radical. Both of those things were present. And I think it's important in understanding him to pull him out of his cave and to put him in front of the satellite television that he's watching and to think about his use of technology and modernity, because it's quite different from the image that we correctly have, for instance, of the Taliban, whose theology holds that technology is forbidden because it wasn't present during the life of the Prophet Muhammad.
And you describe Osama as a great consumer of Western media.
Yeah, he's, well, clearly, if you read his texts and listen to his statements, you don't have to guess. He is following the news, he's watching the news, he's reading books, and he's either watching the news on satellite TV or on the internet, but he's staying up to date.
Although nobody could have imagined at the time that the anti-Soviet forces in Afghanistan would become the people who organized 9/11, wasn't there any worry about encouraging Islamic fundamentalism at the time?
Well, there certainly was. There were people inside the U.S. government who argued, beginning in the 1986-87 period, that U.S. policy was on the wrong track because of its tolerance of the Pakistani army's support for these radical groups using U.S. funds and U.S. weapons.
Not in Charlie Wilson's War. I saw that movie.
Well, but in the actual documents that describe the actual history of what happened, there are dissenting voices that warn quite presciently that if the United States does not stop supporting anti-American Islamists primarily, that it's going to reap consequences. No one obviously forecasted the specific narrative that unfolded, but as in broad terms, they saw what was coming.
Does Osama have, and the group around him, have a real manifesto? When we hear from Hamas or Hezbollah, we hear real stated goals, but it seems very fuzzy hear from Al-Qaeda.
I mean, Osama has many talents, but sort of coherent writing and ideology is not his hallmark. There are ways in which I think he's different from Hamas because he isn't concerned with territory bounded by borders. He's not interested in Westphalian states. He's moved beyond that. He's trying to resurrect an imagined community that is rooted in historical Islam and the resurrection of a caliphate. So
he wants to be the new Saladin?
He wants to be the new Saladin. But even that, you know, if you read him carefully, and for better or worse, I've read everything he's ever written or said, as far as I know, he veers all the time between sort of ordinary political analysis that is kind of territorial, and you think, well, perhaps he's susceptible to co-option or something. But then in the next paragraph, he'll be speaking about a millenarian war that he is destined to fight until Judgment Day, and really that's the only thing that's at issue here. And he'll go back and forth between mystical poetry and very sort of ordinary punditry in the course of a single essay two or three times. So it's very difficult to discern from that a coherent philosophy.
He seems to have short-term goals and long-term goals. He offered peace with the EU if they withdrew from Iraq, but at the same time, you get the feeling that there's really nothing that anybody in the West could do to pacify him.
I agree with that. And I actually don't think that he's not very consistent about these political offers that he makes. He'll throw out a truce of that sort. You're not really sure if it's coming from him or from his political committee. And then a week later, he'll say, well, actually, the only thing that you could do would be to convert to Islam. And then as you join my community, perhaps we would have a different relationship. So, you know, that's kind of a wide range of propositions.
So do we have any idea how important a role Osama played in the planning for 9/11?
Well, I take at face value until proven otherwise the authenticity of the video that surfaced with the visiting sheikh. The transcript of that video is very clear about his involvement with and the nature of his authorship of the tactics of the attack and even thinking about what would happen to the buildings and so forth.
It was a fairly small group at the time.
Al-Qaeda's leadership and membership, fully sworn membership, was certainly in the low hundreds at that time. Affiliated fighters, you know, more than that, but a small group.
And now it's become a brand name, and everybody who wants to go on jihad says we're Al-Qaeda of whatever.
Yeah, I think Al-Qaeda today is several things at the same time. It's an organization still. There's a core organization that has revived along the Afghan frontier and is carrying out specific attacks. Nothing so far successfully as ambitious as 9/11, but imagining big attacks like the one that was supposed to take down planes over the Atlantic Ocean in August of 2006. So there's still an Al-Qaeda, the organization. There's Al-Qaeda, the movement, the sort of broader attempt to inflame like-minded militias and groups and individuals. There's Al-Qaeda, the network, of affiliated organizations. And then, as you say, there's sort of Al-Qaeda, the brand. And I think the most useful way to think about them is as a synthesis of all those things. You can talk about proportions, but I think all of those things describe them.
If he had been captured or killed in Tora Bora in 2001, do you believe that we'd be in any less real danger these days?
I think it certainly wouldn't have hurt. The question of whether Al-Qaeda can manage a succession after the death of bin Laden and Zawahiri is unproven. And so until they manage it successfully, you can at least speculate that they may have some trouble with that. Their leadership has been stable for an awfully long time, and were it to suddenly change, I think it's not obvious what would happen.
The subtitle of your book is An Arabian Family in the American Century, and we really haven't talked all that much about the American aspect of this story. How big is it?
Well, I was interested in the whole of the family's experience, not just in Osama's, though obviously one purpose was to sort of reinterpret him in light of his identity as a bin Laden and as a Saudi. But I was also just interested in using the family's narrative to explore in a specific way the Saudi experience of the 20th century that he arose from, using Saudi advisedly and acknowledging that they were Yemeni in origin. And I think what was so striking about that broader narrative of the family's experience from which Osama arose was that all of the sort of questions that Saudis of his generation wrestled with, questions of identity, questions of choice, faith versus freedom, what kind of global life would you lead, all of those questions were inseparable from the American presence in the kingdom, both politically and economically and culturally. American brands, American cars, American ideas were an inseparable part of that generation's experience.
American friendship with,
American
with the kings.
Yeah, and mostly.
And I'm sure some of the bin Ladens have at least been to parties with the Bushes and with the Cheneys.
You bet, yeah. And with Prince Charles and lots of other figures in the West. And, you know, most of them navigated this path successfully in one way or another. They might veer from one side to another and change their mind about who they were over the course of a lifetime, but that's not so different from the rest of us.
Well, what happened to the family? Are there some who are really upset with Osama for causing so much trouble, or do they all feel that there's a certain kind of a family unity that must be maintained?
Well, it's hard to speak with utter confidence about that because
you spoke to some of the family.
Well, I did, and I have a sense of what they say and what they feel, but it's, you know, their interior experiences of this extraordinary transformation in their family's reputation and experience the primary response that they have given is silence. They have issued a few statements repudiating Osama, but I don't doubt the sincerity of those statements. But it is notable that they've really not come out and explained themselves or shared their experience of revulsion or confusion or conflicting feelings, whatever it is. And I think that's because they're under extraordinary pressure. In the West, their family is seen as the spawn, the source of a mass murderer. In the Arabian world, at least initially after in Arabia, he was kind of a folk hero. And there was also a fear that if they spoke out too harshly against him, they might themselves become a target of his followers and his movement. So all of these pressures seem to have combined to convince them just to stay quiet and keep their heads down.
Steve Call's latest book is The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. It is published by the Penguin Press. Mr. Call has also become the director of the nonprofit New America Foundation. And he assures me, continue to engage in journalism despite that other job.
You bet. I wouldn't have it otherwise.
And I look forward to seeing you with the next book.
Thank you, Leonard. Pleasure as always.
Steve Call will be speaking and signing books tomorrow, that's April 2nd at 7:30, at the Lincoln Square Barnes & Noble store on 1972 Broadway at 66th Street. Also, Steve was last on the show a couple of years ago to talk about the history of the CIA in Afghanistan, and we have a link to that posted on our show page at WNYC.org if you want to hear more of this story. Up next, Kurt Vonnegut's son, Mark Vonnegut, talks about a new collection of his father's writings on war and peace. This is WNYC, and WNYC.org.